Hello and welcome to the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michaela, and today I have the pleasure to talk to Tomáš Vakomi. But before I start, let me share some fantastic news. The podcast has gotten its first sponsor. I'm so happy about this because it means I can focus even more on producing episodes for you. And it's not any sponsor, it's an amazing match. Actually, two founders, Tracy and Dom, reached out to me. They are building CodeSubmit, a take-home assignment platform to streamline your tech recruiting. They are already profitable and they are part of the Tiny Seed Accelerator. The reason for them to build CodeSubmit is because they strongly believe that take-home challenges are the most candidate-friendly way of assessing developer talent, and they could not find a dedicated tool for that. So they set out to build the best experience for take-home assignments for hiring managers and developers. It's built on Git and they support 64 different languages and frameworks. Even though it's a young startup and it's built the indie way, they already work with hundreds of companies. Well, last weekend they showed me the whole experience and it's fantastic. So I really hope you go and check out CodeSubmit. You can find it at codesubmit.io and they also offer a free trial. Well, if you like it, please give them some love on social media for sponsoring this episode. But now back to Tomáš. Tomáš is a senior front-end engineer at the OLX Group, which is a fast-growing platform for trading businesses. Tomáš is also an EdHack instructor, he's certified for AWS, and he's a speaker and blogger. So I'm really happy to have Tomáš here with me. Tomáš, welcome to the show.
Hello everyone, I'm very happy to be here.
So Tomáš, maybe as a start, can you tell me a little bit about your role at OLX Group? On the website, it says it's a platform for buying and selling cars, finding housing, getting jobs, buying and selling household goods. But what are your team's responsibilities? What are your tasks at this company?
Sure. So as you've mentioned, like basically what we do at OLX Group is that we build a huge number of different websites for like buying stuff, selling stuff. So as you mentioned, we have cars, we have real estate, we have goods, we have services. So there's basically lots of things going on. And obviously, you know, my team in particular, like we cannot be responsible for everything. The way we work at OLX Group is that each team is focused on a certain area of the business and they own it completely. So my team is focused on OLX jobs because not only you can buy stuff, but you can also find a better, hopefully, job at OLX. So what we are building is that we are building solutions that help people find a newer, better job. In particular, we are working on something that is called a candidate profile because the idea that we have in mind is that, you know, CVs are kind of outdated because this concept of a CV has been around for ages and we need something better. So not only people can create basically their profile at OLX, but we also are going to use the data in that profile in order to find people a better job automatically because we send them recommendations based on their profile and also based on the job ads that were actually they were going through on our site. So we are kind of trying to find a better job for them.
Okay. So can I imagine it as like LinkedIn, but a little bit different, or is it very different?
It is somewhat different than LinkedIn. I think like LinkedIn is very focused on like white collar jobs. So, you know, white collar, basically what I mean by that is that, you know, you work in the office, you probably have a project, you probably have a title that is in English, and you probably spend your time in front of a computer. And this is not the reality of, like, I suppose, like majority of people, because people have different careers, people have different skills and whatnot. So what we are trying to build is to have a product that is somewhat similar to LinkedIn, as in you create a profile and you can use it to find a better job, but with a much broader focus. So we want to target basically everyone who's looking for a job in Poland and also help them find a better job. Because like not everybody is used to, you know, searching for a job offer online, not everybody is to negotiating. So one of the experiments that we've had a couple of months ago is also building a platform in which the employer would have to provide a salary range. Because we also would like to, in ideal case scenario, avoid this process of, you know, whenever you have to renegotiate a salary, how much do you want? How much are you willing to give me? How much do you want? And so back and so forth.
Yeah, for me, it's always mind-blowing that, you know, to be honest, I haven't known about OLX before, right? And so for this podcast, I researched it a little bit and I went on the website and I see like these large numbers of employees that you have. And then I went to the career side and I see, wow, on the top of my head, I think there were like 16 open positions in data analysis or data engineering, something like this, right? Then there were like 80 positions for engineers, right? And I was like, wow, because I worked as a data scientist or like a researcher before, right? And sometimes struggling, like, where are the companies that are actually hiring, you know, people with these skill sets? And then you're stumbling across a company that you never heard of and you think like, well, this is not a small company, it's a large corporation, right, that you're actually working for. And so, yeah, maybe what would be interesting for me is like, well, you said my team, right? So my team, and then you're working with data scientists. What are other engineers that you are working with, right? You're a front-end engineer. So who is on your team? You know, do you have like testers on your team? Do you have like designers on your team? And then you're working with data scientists. How does the communication work like this? Can you tell me a little bit about the structure and, you know, how are teams collaborating at OLX?
Sure. So the way we kind of work at OLX group is that each team is a pack. So we are divided into something that is called a pack. And a pack is this like self-contained unit of the organization that can ship their stuff to production. So each pack has, you know, if you need front-end engineers, you have a front-end engineer, you have back-end engineers, you have product managers. There's usually an engineering manager if there are, you know, engineers on the team. That kind of role is also useful. Some teams have a dedicated designer. Some teams are working closely with the designers, but they're not necessarily in that team because some teams have like different needs when it comes to things like design. We also have a business analyst in our team. So again, like this is a very kind of self-contained unit. What I really like about this setup is because I used to work in the companies where we had a front-end department and we had a back-end department. And not only was communication tricky, but also working in an actual agile way was somewhat difficult because as a front-end engineer, if I wanted to get, by the way, I would like to get this one more piece of data from the backend, then you had to go to the backend team, talk to them, but they apparently have their priorities for this sprint, so you have to wait for the next sprint and whatnot. Whereas in our current setup, we work very closely together. So we are not working in a silo, but quite the contrary. We are, you know, working very closely together with backend engineers, front-end engineers, all of those skill sets that are required to build amazing products. Everything is included in that team. And I am very proud as a front-end engineer of our backend engineers because they are actually submitting feedback when it comes to design and when it comes to UX solutions that we build. So this is something that I haven't seen before, like this level of commitment to building great products and not only, you know, juggling JSON data as some of backend engineers I used to do.
Okay, yeah. And so how many front-end engineers are, for example, in your team?
Those teams, they don't have to be very large. So in my team currently, we have two front-end engineers. There's two backend engineers. We have a dedicated contact in a data science team. So he's not, you know, technically in our team, but we are working very closely together. We also have a dedicated designer, a product manager, business analyst, and my engineering manager. So there's less than 10 people in total. I like this role that each team should be large enough that a one pizza can fit the entire team. And I think this is a good metric for how large the team should be.
Yeah, I like that. Well, with 10 people and one pizza, I mean, everybody gets a little slice, really.
Yeah, it's technically viable.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the things that I love is code reviews. And so if you have like two front-end engineers, do you do code reviews for each other or do you have like the back-end engineers also looking at your code and are you looking at the code of back-end engineers and vice versa? Or is that like very dedicated like for the roles?
So there's a couple of things here. First up, each one of us tries to grow. So I am trying my best to kind of review infrastructure changes. We are using serverless framework. Sometimes backend engineers are eager to take a look into what's happening on front-end side. But the way it usually happens is that my team is only a small part of a way larger organization. So we have lots of front-end engineers, back-end engineers, and whatnot. So because those teams are self-contained, you may have this impression that we are working, you know, completely alone in a silo. We like, you know, don't look at what we are doing, leave us alone. This is not the case. So front-end engineers from other teams, they're reviewing my stuff. I am doing my best to review their code and whatnot. So I think this is quite useful because, first of all, we do require two approvals on each merge request. So by definition, if there are two of us, I cannot approve my own stuff. So I have to get somebody else from another team to also approve my changes. But it also builds this culture of at least having this vague idea of what the other teams are doing. And if should there be a need, they can also contribute to our code bases and vice versa.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And so now I imagine you, right? You like this one pack, and now this is a large corporation or a large organization. So I'm thinking, well, there's your pack, and then you're probably maybe 20 other packs or even more, right? So how do you select the packs that would review your code? And would it be always the same? You know, like do you have like two other packs that you are like, you know, working together, or do you randomly allocate people from different packs to look at your code?
I would say it depends on the scope of the changes, because I am working in a pack that is, like I said, we are building products for jobs. So we are helping people find a better job. There are also other packs that are also in this kind of like job ecosystem. So they are building other solutions, for instance, for recruiters. So if my change is roughly in this domain of looking for a job, so this is like in this part of the code base, or there's this context of, you know, the stuff that we are actually currently building, if necessary, I am probably going to ask for code review, you know, some of the members of that team. But if I'm doing something that is more like platform related, so I'm making kind of like core changes, I don't know, I'm updating a very major dependency in our code base, I'm probably going to reach out to somebody from our platform team. Because one thing that I especially hate as a front-end engineer is breaking production. And my goal as a developer, while, you know, kind of passionate about testing in general, is I don't want to break production.
So I actually read through one of your articles that you also have mentioned on LinkedIn as one of the articles that you are most proud of, that's most popular, something like this. It's called 7 years as a software developer, right? The lessons that you have learned there. And you were talking about code reviews again, right? And so one of the things that you were saying, and I'm just now quoting you verbatim more or less, right? You were saying, I've personally seen people submitting code reviews when X, right, a person wasn't in the office, or Y was at a business trip. X was a brilliant programmer, but enduring through his code reviews process was a chore. If you leave 50 nitpicks, unkind comments under a PR of someone who is a junior programmer, you're not proving your superiority as a developer. You are proving that you're not a good human being, right? And so, how do you handle that? Like, how do you handle unkind comments, and how do you surface that as a company, as a team? You know, how do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm. So at the beginning, I would like to add that if I were to write this part again, I would probably add some more nuance to it. That was a little bit of a hot take, and you know, there were lots of comments on Reddit regarding that part, because it seems to kind of cause a little bit of attention. Which I don't think it's necessary to do, because the main point is still there. You should be kind to other people. When it comes to kind of like dealing with that, I think it's not easy, and you are probably the best person in the world to talk regarding like having better code reviews. But nevertheless, my personal idea is that you should always try to reach out to somebody when there are, for instance, like leaving unkind comments in code reviews, because there are two things that may be happening. First of all, they maybe are not aware that, you know, their comments are unkind. Maybe they are just trying to be direct. Maybe they didn't have the time to kind of, I don't know, use the word please in a sentence, which I think it should happen anyways. But it could also be that something is actually happening in their personal lives and they are not really feeling, you know, like doing code reviews today. So that's one thing that could happen. But nevertheless, I would, you know, always reach out to that person and say, by the way, those are our kind of like code review guidelines. we are reviewing the code, we are not reviewing the person. So, you know, please try to be kind. And regarding like bad code, because, you know, when you leave like 50 comments on a code review and you are very nitpicky, you probably think that this code is terrible. I like to think that everybody tries to do their job as best as they possibly can. Nobody as a developer, nobody is going to go to work in the morning and says, I'm going to write some terrible code today. Nobody does that. So when you are seeing something in code review that you are shocked, that you think is terrible, consider that you are maybe not aware of their constraints. Maybe there's some context that you are not aware of. Maybe there's something that should be improved. Maybe you should talk to them. Maybe if you see a code review that doesn't have any tests whatsoever, maybe propose to pair up and write those tests together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like, and you also had that actually in your blog post, right? You were saying, well, go and change the channel, the communication channel, right? So instead of leaving all those comments in the code review, why not reaching out to the person directly and asking, you know, if you can be, as you said, of help in a different way, right? And I think that's really important. So, and maybe I want to come back to one of the things that you said at the beginning is like, well, I would definitely reach out, but do you see yourself reaching out as the person that gets this critique, or is it like you're a senior engineer, right? So would you also reach out to the person if you see they are leaving unkind comments from somebody else?
I would be much more quicker to reach out if it was somebody else, for the record, because I have a feeling that as a senior in an organization, like your job is not to only write code, but your job is also make others more productive and also build an environment in which people are feeling okay to kind of express their ideas, express their concerns and whatnot. So if luckily it doesn't happen for the record, like this thing that I've written about in the article, it happened years ago. And it doesn't really happen in my current company, which is something that I'm very happy to see. But nevertheless, if I were to see a situation in which somebody more senior is kind of attacking a more junior engineer in a code review, I would definitely reach out to that reviewer saying that this is not okay. This is not something that we do. Because think about it. Some people are not used to code reviews. Code reviews are very public. And it doesn't make people like feel necessarily good that I am, you know, I've just started at this company 2 weeks ago, and now I have a merge request with like 50 comments in it. Maybe I'm a fraud. Maybe I shouldn't be hired here in the first place. Like, this is not the kind of environment that you want to build in a software organization.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're talking about a lot of different things here. And one is, for example, the context that you have when you're doing code reviews, right? So this person, you were talking about the person that's just starting. So this person probably needs something very different in a code review than a person that's, you know, stable at this company already, or have found their place in this company, in the team, for example. And so, yeah, you're totally right. There's so many different things that influence that. And so when I work with engineers on code reviews, and they're telling me those, or, you know, sometimes people are afraid even to tell that, but somehow it surfaces, right? And they say, well, code reviews is the problem. But I really think it's not the code reviews that are the problem, it's the team culture. So if things like this happen in code reviews, then it's not the code reviews, it's the code reviews surfacing that. And I think on one hand, this is even good, because now you can see it, right? You can see things that are happening in a more subtle way in meetings and, you know, in work coordinations or collaborations, you know, who reaches out to whom and how do you give, you know, orders or things like this. So in hierarchical organizations. Well, so I know something else that I wanted to talk with you about, and that's technical debt. And so I know that your organization is doing something specific here. Can you tell me a little bit, how are you tackling technical debt? And, you know, how you're working on it? Do you say, well, happens and we never look at it and, you know, close our eyes? Or what are the strategies that you have here?
Okay, so first of all, if any large software organization is saying that they don't have technical debt, they're absolutely lying. Everybody has technical debt, including us, for the record. So from my own perspective, I'm very happy to be in a somewhat greenfield project. So we don't have a lot of tech debt, mostly because we are building, you know, completely new features and functionality on top of existing stack. But nevertheless, we are also integrating with something that was certain, and some of it is definitely technical debt. So there are a couple of things that we have been doing so far in order to address that, because we have to, you know, continue. We have to continue development. We have to continue building, you know, experiences for our users. But nevertheless, we have to be able to do so in the first place. And when technical debt is high enough, you cannot do it anymore. So we having this concept of a war room. And this is something that we did a bunch of times. And we basically have two types of war rooms. So first up, we have those war rooms where you gather a group of engineers who are interested in a certain area. So for instance, I don't know, we have problems with our Redis, or we have problems in our front-end performance. We're going to gather a group of engineers who are interested in that area, and they will be able to help. So they will be not like full-time building on new features and experiences, but some part of the work, for instance, like 50%, will be spent, you know, focusing on fixing technical debt in order to unlock everybody. But we also had a case in which we unfortunately had to stop, and we had a basically like a company, maybe not necessarily company-wide, but department-wide a war room. That is, we were not working on anything new for, if I remember correctly, 2 weeks, and we did manage to combat a massive portion of our tech debt. And my takeaway from all of that is that you have to actively plan for fixing tech debt. For my money, this is not something that happens in the meantime. This is not, because I work in some teams, and there was this idea that each sprint we're going to spend 20% of our time on tech debt. This rarely, rarely works. What I think works so much better is to have dedicated time and dedicated people who are passionate about, you know, fixing technical debt. In my humble opinion, the best way to address, for instance, like performance issues is to gather 4 engineers who are passionate about performance and leave them alone for 2 weeks. You will be very much surprised with the results.
Yeah, definitely. And it becomes a project, right? It's not like something that you have to fix on the side, which is, you know, in your way and actually distracting you from something. And it's also achievement. Like if you give them, this is a project then, and it's achievement that you can achieve. And it's not something like, oh, you haven't worked on that feature. Well, I did something, you know, but because you're always like, it's like drops that you're putting, right? So you don't see them. They are dropping and, you know, like on a stone, and it's so hot that you don't see the drop, right? So you really have to have it rain that the stone somehow cools down, which also reminds me on Automattic, for example. So I had like Life Singer on my show, and he was talking about Automattic, and what they do is they stop feature work for, I forgot the timing, but it's impressive. And they just do technical debt, right? Just do everything that they didn't, you know, do before. And they also get so much done, and it's the whole company. Everybody does this now, and this is our number one priority. And he also said, like, it's really helping a lot because, you know, you have this focus, you have this dedication, and it's not like a distraction on the side that nobody wants really to take on. So when I looked at your LinkedIn profile, I not only saw, you know, where you're working at right now, but I also saw a list of things that you're doing outside of work, or, you know, partially at work or whatnot, right? So you're also an AGHead instructor. And I think I remember correctly, you said like you have 150 videos or something. Is that correct?
More than 170 at this point.
Wow, more than 170. So how are you doing that? Like, this is something that fascinates me, and I just have to get more time and get better at all of those, you know, recording stuff and things like this. But this is definitely something that I aspire to do as well. How do you do those videos? You know, what motivates you to do them? How did you become an AGHead instructor? And yeah, can you tell me a little bit about that?
So first of all, I was not really recording videos before I started, you know, as an AGHead instructor. I was writing on my blog, I was doing conference talks, and this is basically how I got noticed, because people at AGHead basically noticed that I have a way of kind of teaching people what I know, and I'm passionate about, you know, teaching basically everything that I know. That is kind of one of my personal goals, is to share as much as from what I know with others. When it comes to recording over 170 videos, I recorded one video, then I did it again, then I did it again, then I did it again, because this is how you get to this kind of level. I was absolutely not planning on recording so many videos when I started 2 years ago, nearly to the day, 2 years ago.
Okay, wow.
I remember at the very beginning, and I had this feeling that, what am I going to record? I have nothing to teach. This is not exactly true. I think like if you have non-trivial experience as a developer, you definitely have something to teach others. And if you have this feeling that you have definitely nothing more to teach, well, this is a good time for you to learn something new. And I found myself that I learned the best by teaching. So the best way for me to solidify something that I've learned relatively recently is to write a blog post about it or record a video.
Mm-hmm. And so you do it from a work process perspective. Do you write a blog post first and then you make the video, or do you make a video first, or you just make videos for things that you think that are better covered in a video and you write a blog post for things that you think better are, you know, covered in a blog post? How does that work?
That's a good question. What I basically do when I want to share something with others, I mostly try to think what resource would be useful to me. Because like some concepts are amazingly well explained as a blog post because you can search through it and whatnot. Some topics are better when it comes to a video. So for instance, I have a blog post on my screen right now. I was watching this amazing talk about cookies, tokens, and APIs, kind of like this in-depth dive into those topics. And I was doing some notes and basically into blog post that I published yesterday. So this works great as a blog post because a video of me doing this content is no better than the conference talk that I've just watched. But if I were to try to explain something that is a bit more visual, so how do you do something in AWS console, then video works so much better than this.
Yeah, yeah. And so you just said AWS, so I know that you are AWS certified. What do you do there? How did you, you know, was it a requirement from your job, or why did you set out to do that certification? And I also saw that you are going to the next level from AWS certified. And yeah, what motivates you to do that?
So there are two things here. So first of all, OLX has been OLX is basically on AWS. We have migrated everything to AWS, I think like 2 years ago. My team, we are working with GraphQL stack, which is based in AWS. So we have API gateways, we have Lambda functions, we are using DynamoDB as storage, SQS. So there's lots of different AWS services. And I've joined the company as a front-end engineer, and I am still a front-end engineer. But when I joined, I had little to no idea about AWS. I was completely green in that area. So after a while, my manager kind of encouraged me to learn more about this, because the idea was, if you want to be able to contribute more, if you want to be able to contribute to the technical discussions that we have, to architecture decisions, you should probably know what is going on. And getting certified is a good way to accomplish that for two reasons. Because there's this structured system of learning in order to become certified. Because there's basically a list of topics that you have to be knowledgeable in order to pass the exam. Right? So you have this structured idea of what do I need to learn, as opposed to I'm going to learn everything because this is not viable with AWS. And secondly, you have some sort of a proof that you have at least a vague idea of what you are talking about when it comes to AWS. And like I said, in 10 days from now, I am going to pass another exam. So this is the AWS developer. And I sure hope I'm going to pass it, because this episode is going to probably be live after my exam.
Yeah. It could be, yeah. So, yeah. And well, one of the question that comes to my mind, you said, well, when I joined OLX, I was a front-end engineer. I'm still a front-end engineer. But at that point, I didn't know AWS. I guess in their job posting, I don't know, maybe you reacted to that, or I don't know how you were hired or how you were, you know, getting the information that there is this description. Maybe they said you should know AWS, or it's preferred that you know it, something like this. And how do you communicate that? Can you tell me a little bit about your hiring experience, you know, and, you know, what questions were you asked? How was that process going? And yeah, that would be interesting.
So the fun thing is that I've joined 2.5 years ago, and I have a feeling that I've joined a somewhat different company because we are, you know, changing and growing quite rapidly. So, I mean, I can talk about the process that we have today because I am also kind of involved in the hiring process because I'm interviewing somebody basically every week. But nevertheless, when it comes back to AWS plus frontend, we absolutely do not expect frontend engineers to have AWS experience. I wanted to learn something new. I wanted to grow. This is why I am interested in that area. Nevertheless, I do recommend to keep your eyes open. Like, we don't explicitly expect AWS experience, but nevertheless, I think it is useful. But when it comes to hiring process itself, we have a bunch of interviews in our hiring process. So from my kind of technical perspective, we have two types of interviews. So there's a strictly technical interview in which we are, you know, talking about somebody's experiences. We are also kind of diving into some topics when it comes to JavaScript, to React and whatnot. And we also have a second interview, which is a system design interview. So the idea is that we give you a problem, an architectural problem, and we basically have this conversation about how would you solve that problem, what kind of technologies would you use, how would you use them, how would you test that, how would you monitor that, and so on. It's actually one of my favorites because you get to learn how other people are thinking about building software and, you know, front-end architectures. And this is, I learn as much as they do on those interviews.
And so now you are at the company. Do you have like a career ladder there? Do you have like some, you know, when I was working at Microsoft, there was like these really set in stone things that you have to accomplish to get to the next level. You know, what should be your, you know, skills technically, you know, professionally and so on. How does that work at OLX?
So we do have a career ladder that is branching at the end into somewhat like a tree. So there's junior, there's mid-level / regular engineer, there's senior engineer, and after a senior engineer, so basically where I am, there's this tree is going to branch out. So there's a manager's path and there's an individual contributor path. So in manager's path, you can become an engineering manager. Afterwards, you can become a head or director of engineering. Afterwards, probably a CTO or something. I'm not, you know, even thinking about this level right now. On the individual contributor path, we have lead engineers and principal engineers and chief engineers, if I remember correctly. So basically what we want to do is to avoid this problem that I saw at my very first company, where you had senior developers who were promoted to engineering managers, not because they had manager skills, but you had to promote them somewhere, and that was the only basic option. And some engineers are terrible managers because managing people is a completely different job than, you know, being a senior software engineer.
Mm-hmm. And so where do you want to go? Like, you're now in this, you know, one step before. So when you're branching out, which direction will you go? Will you go into the management route or will you go into the lead engineer route?
I would like to go into the lead engineer route, because I'm the kind of person who likes to make an impact in the organization, but mostly from like a technical perspective and mostly from the perspective of how do we build software? How do we think about front end? How do we think about, you know, quality and whatnot? Because like all companies, we have more work to do. As all companies, we would like to improve, and having, you know, people having more people in those kind of like leadership, technical leadership roles, helps us kind of draw the picture of where we would like to be in, I don't know, in 2 years, in 5 years, and whatnot. I am not entirely sure whether I would be the best manager alive. Definitely not a remote manager. Maybe if this wasn't, you know, the year of 2020 where everybody is working remotely, that would be probably a different story. But as of right now, I am gearing towards the lead engineer's path.
And so one of the things that when I hear you talking, right, it feels like you are very involved in the decisions that are made about, you know, for example, how do we tackle technical debt, right? Do we do this war rooms? Are people involved in those discussions about, you know, how do we actually build our culture internally? How do we, and especially obviously also engineering, right? What role does code review have for us? Is that something that you feel that you can actively change? Or is it something that others are thinking about and you are adopting it?
So we have a couple of company values, and two of them are my favorites. So the first one is be open, and the second one is to take ownership. And I am mentioning that because most kind of like senior engineers in our organization, like we have this strong sense of ownership. So we are not building something in that way because, I don't know, somebody from higher above told us to. We want to build, you know, the best experiences that we possibly can. And if we feel like we should improve in some area, so for instance, well, I don't know, imagine that we were not doing code reviews at all. And right now we have a group of engineers who are saying, hey, we want to do code reviews. We get to kind of influence that. Our, you know, technical directors are very open to communication, to discussion. So it's not like there are, you know, those know them all kind of people. They are very, you know, kind of eager and to not only to discuss, but also to listen to our feedback and to improve and also grow on each other. We also have this process, kind of like a request for comments, documents. So if you, as an engineer, if you feel like something is not 100% okay, like there are some processes that could be improved, you can always write a document, ask others for feedback, and maybe like this document is going to become basically the way we do that thing from now on at OLX.
Yeah, so one of the things that I know is your area is somehow testing. And I know that I asked that question today on Twitter, you know, what people want me to ask you, and testing was one of the things. And you said, well, you're doing testing if your skills are not really good, right?
Yeah, if you don't trust yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more about your philosophy here? And
so my philosophy when it comes to testing is that I want to sleep better at night. I don't want to worry about my changes back in production. I am not brave enough to push major features to productions that don't have tests, basically. So when it comes to that, I strongly believe that something that is not tested is not done. And this tweet that you are referring to is from my colleague of mine, Jędrzej, and we have this internal joke that tests slow down development. Because if you build a feature and you write the test, it is twice the work, right?
Yeah.
But imagine that you are building a house. You could probably build it faster with having cheaper materials. Maybe you don't wait. Maybe you shouldn't wait this long for the concrete, to finish like whatever the concrete is doing, if you know what I mean. Maybe it is a better idea to have solid foundations on how we build software and then to kind of improve upon them. Because my own impression after working here for 2.5 years is that we are building websites and experiences for huge number of people. OLX in Poland is in top 10 most visited websites in this country. My mom is using OLX. I don't get to break production on some obvious mistakes, because production incidents will happen always. But I have a feeling that as engineers, we kind of get to choose what kind of production incidents are not going to happen at all, because we've managed to test and make sure that, I don't know, it is not possible for our login page to be empty.
Yeah. And I also think, slowing down, I think it's a little bit a wrong perception, because you're not only writing code, right? So there's this task that you're writing code, but then actually code lives on, right? So, and you want to have it live on for a long time. And so if you think like this is the first investment that you're making, and then based on this investment, you're profiting from it, right? But while you're profiting, you actually have to maintain the code. And so if you're, as you said, if you're building a better foundation and if you're adding tests, right, and if you know your foundation is actually good, in the long run, you will have less iteration on, maintaining that thing to improve it, to fix things that are, broken or wrong. And so I think in the end, it amortize it itself over time very, very quickly. Yeah. So yeah, I definitely think that's true. So one of the things that you also mentioned was product-driven mindset. What is a product-driven mindset, and you know, how can we get that?
Sure. So the way I think about it is, my job is not to push tickets in Jira from to do to done. My job is to build products. So the way I think about it is, as an engineer, I think that the best products are built by people who have this great understanding of what exactly are they building. And this is sometimes referred to as business context. So I don't know, I am not adding this form to make my manager happy. I am adding this form so that our users can, I don't know, add their bank account number to their account. But when you go one level above and think about what kind of problems am I trying to solve, then I feel you are building better products, because it's not about the form. The form is the way we address an actual problem that our users have, their actual need. So as an engineer, we may think, okay, why are we adding this form in the first place? Maybe we could do it in some other way. Maybe we could get this data from this other, I know, microservice that already has this data. Maybe we could talk to that people. And this product-driven mindset means that you don't necessarily think about the stuff that you are building in terms of, again, Jira tickets. You think about, okay, this is the problem that we are trying to solve. How can we do that with, maybe without even writing any code at all? Because some problems can be solved by, I don't know, an email. I have this example that I often give, that we had this idea that we wanted to ask our users feedback on a certain feature. This feature was not used by many people, so we wanted to kind of have a survey inside, you know, of this page. But then we decided that we are going to just send an email to them, because it took us 10 minutes and we got exactly the same kind of feedback that we had if we were to build a form or survey.
Yeah. And so what came to my mind when you were talking about this is that I mean, there are definitely engineers that don't want or that don't care so much about the product. And I, again, think it's not the engineer themselves. I think it's the culture in the company, right? That at one point you give it up, maybe. You just say, well, yeah, it doesn't actually matter what I think. So we just do what we are asked to, because that's what we are incentivized for. And that, you know, that's what our incentive structure is all about. And I cannot change anything, right? Even if I think this is not the right step for the product. But I also think that sometimes there is like this business driven mindset, right? So there are like those two things that are a little bit competing with each other, right? So there's this product driven mindset, which I think is maybe easier to adopt as an engineer, because we like to create, and we maybe are even taught about, you know, how to think about the users and how. But then what's a little bit even further away from an engineer is this business driven mindset, right? So let's say a large corporation, right? And they have like a tool, and it's for code reviews. And so you have all these great ideas as engineers how to improve this code review tool. But there's this business aspect which says, well, we are much bigger than code reviews, right? We are doing so much more. So right now, we don't have to make the best product for code reviews. And so somehow this idea about, you know, making the best product becomes a little bit diluted by, you know, the business goals that you have as well, which are not always the product goals. I don't know if this makes sense to you, if you feel that as well, but this is something that I feel it's very often very challenging and very demotivating, can also be very demotivating, because I think, you know, it's easy to fall in love with your product, right? It's a little bit harder to fall in love with business goals. I don't know.
Exactly. I know definitely what you mean. Because I can give you an example. So we are running ads on OLX. Every large website is running ads. We are no exception. And engineers are, you know, we don't like ads. We don't like, you know, having additional scripts that are loaded on our beautifully crafted pages with, I don't know, Google Ads or whatever. And then we get informed that, by the way, this is paying X percent of your salary, right? Because ads, you know, we are not putting those ads for because we want to, right? We are putting those ads because they help us, you know, build our business and, you know, earn more money for the business. And I completely agree with you that sometimes it is difficult to kind of figure out why we should do a certain thing. And I think like it's always important, both in programming, product, and business, to try to figure out what do we optimize for at a given moment, right? So are we optimizing for growth in our user base? Are we optimizing for the best possible product? Or are we optimizing for the greatest revenue? Because doing all of those at the same time is largely impossible.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I find it always quite challenging, especially like all those, even though you know it, it's not pleasant, right? So even though you know, okay, the ads are now paying part of my salary, it's still not a pleasant feeling. Like, oh, the performance goes down. That's horrible. Can we block it? Where's the ad blocker, right?
Can we mine Bitcoin instead?
yeah, exactly, right. Yeah, very cool. So, well, I think we actually reached the end of our session today, of the interview. Is there something that you want to share with my listeners that we haven't touched on that you think is would be important, or something that you want to tell them, some advice that you want to give them on their way?
Okay, so I had this thought like literally yesterday, because I'm not sure whether you are listening, you know, you the listener, if you are a student or if you are, you know, way like kind of like younger than me. Apologies, I've turned 30 this year, and this is you know a major moment for me. But I was thinking out today about when I was studying at the university. I have a master's degree in electronics and telecommunications. How somewhat irrelevant this degree is to my career. If you are studying in a computer science degree, you were probably going to become a developer, and some of those skills are going to be useful. But nevertheless, I wanted to kind of express this idea that if you are, I don't know, in a college, if you basically have chosen a wrong major for yourself and you have any doubts, I have this strong feeling that, you know, your university is basically not kind of like defining point of your life. I am struggling to name like most of the names of my professors from the university, not to mention the kind of the content of the classes that they taught. I am a JavaScript developer, and I didn't write a single line of JavaScript during my engineering degree. So this is something that I would love to hear, I don't know, like 10 years ago for the record.
Yeah. And I also think that there's always a point to change, right? I mean, if you look at my path, there was a big turning point that people would probably say, well, that's the big turning point, right? Is when I finished art school and I went on to do computer science, right? And I didn't have an idea about computers. And so maybe it seems like this is a turning point, a huge turning point, but actually it's not. It wasn't really like this huge turning point when I started from computer science to software engineering, right? When I made this switch, it was probably the same turning point, right? When I then went to, you know, do for my first job was again a very different, you know, experience when I worked as a researcher. And actually over the years, you know, things really, they get less important. And still, you know, every time you do something new, it's again, it feels like, oh my God, can I do that, right? It feels like, oh, this is when I stopped my research position, and people were telling me, you're completely crazy that you do that, right? Who would give up this position? And it felt crazy, and it felt like, oh my God, you know, like, what now? And now it's 1 year later, right? And I feel like, well, it completely changed again. And so I think it's always when we are in the situation, we feel like, oh, this is now so important, right? This is such a defining moment for my life. But actually, we can always change. I mean, even if you don't have a computer science degree or no university degree, you can actually really change. And it's a lot about imposter syndrome also, maybe getting over, you know, yourself and, you know, your feelings or your thoughts in your head that tell you you're not good at that, or because you don't know it, right? You don't know it. When I started my business, my first intention was, I have to do an MBA, right? To be prepared. Let's do an MBA, because somehow, you know, this gives you like some security that you know what you're doing. But I felt like, well, this takes way too long and too much money, right? I don't have it. So I have to just figure it out myself. And I think every step that you're doing, even if you're not, let's say you're, you know, in the fast food industry, and now you think, I want to become also a JavaScript engineer or developer, it feels really unreal and impossible right now, but really these small steps. And I think maybe this brings me back to what you said about your videos, right? I made one video and another video, right? And then you look back and it like it's 2 years later, it's probably not an overnight success, right? You're not waking up, you know, watching one YouTube video, writing your first website, and then next day you are, you know, you accomplished your dream. But if you every day, you know, work on that, I think, yeah, and don't let, you know, whatever happens right now define you. I think we are giving too much weight to what's in the now, right? Which is important on one hand, but you know, it becomes less and less important over the years. So I totally agree. Yeah.
I was supposed to tell this story because this was requested on Twitter, and I think it plays very nicely to what we just talked about. I went skydiving for the very first time this year because, as I mentioned, I've turned 30. My wife decided to attempt, you know, killing me. Therefore, she booked a skydiving session. Luckily, I did get the parachute, so that was actually excellent. But the reason why I'm mentioning this is that it was absolutely scary. But the scariest moment was the night before. I was unable to sleep. I was, you know, laying in my bed. I was going through the skydive over and over in my head, even though I had absolutely no idea what it's going to look like. I watched a video on YouTube, so I have this, you know, vague idea of, you know, I'm going to get into an airplane, we're going to fly up, and then I'm going to jump out of a freaking moving airplane. But when I actually, you know, got there to the airport, then I realized that, you know, some other people are also doing this, and they are not dying. Therefore, I am going to be okay. So I think this is that was a huge important life lesson for me, is that the scariest moment when you are trying to make a huge impact, a huge change, is right before you make the impact. Because as soon as you get to work, as soon as you actually get started, it becomes so much easier. It doesn't mean that it is going to be easy, but it is going to be easier. And with each kind of like additional challenge that you overcome, like those things have a good chance of getting easier. But going back to my exit videos, I struggled a lot recording my very first like 5 or 10 videos. That was a hassle. And honestly, it took me, I don't know, like 3 hours to record a 2-minute video. That was a disaster. Right now, I am so much better than at this. But it took me a while. So you have to, basically, I would recommend that, you know, you should always try to kind of keep improving and go out of your comfort zone and every once in a while if you feel like it. I think that, you know, it is a good idea.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, that's definitely true. So, well, I think it's a perfect ending. Thank you so much, Tomasz, for being on my show and spending the time with me and telling me so much about, you know, how it is to be a software engineer at your company. And yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. That was a pleasure.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Okay, bye-bye.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. But before I let you go, let me tell you that this week, Black Friday, I have some special, really amazing discounts on my code review workshop. So if you ever tinkered with the idea of booking one, I think now is the time. So hop over to awesomecodereviews.com, and I hope to see you in 2 weeks for another episode of the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. Bye.